Okay, so exam is next class and it's on April 1st. So if past years are any indication, who knows, Google might come up with an automated test taking tool and then that can just take the test. Or you might come and there may not be a test, I don't know. I might want to see the entire class in the class one day at least in my life, and one way of doing it is to say there is a test, right? So, okay. And then I used to be basically make this sometimes open book, open notes, but then I think I've decided it would be closed book, closed notes, and you're allowed a sheet of handwritten notes. The hope is that in writing on that sheet with your own hand, by mistake, you might learn something. Right? Whereas if you bring the entire laptop, the hope is that laptop will transfer over to the, you know, to the paper. So when I was a kid, you know, we used to ask our teacher, so tell us some revision questions that would come on the exam. And then there was this one time this guy gave us, and he used to give this like 100 questions. And we would still think that was great, but it turns out that if you actually learned those 100 questions, you learned something. And then 5 of those would come on the exam. So similarly, something, the whole point of exam from your point of view is great. From my point of view is that you will sit down and read everything once. So for a microsecond of this class's life, people will hold this material in their head. And then it goes away until the final comes. Yes?
Are we going to go over any of the questions?
Unless there was a question, I could send solutions, but you know, if you have a specific question, you could either bring it up now or come to my office hours.
Okay. One of my questions was, when we're doing, well, I'll ask later.
Okay. And then it has to be handwritten because I don't want somebody to type it up and other people copy it over. Because again, it's not so much that you would be plagiarizing, but you may not be using your own mind. Okay, that's the only worry. And of course, you don't need to bring a sheet. You can just bring yourself and that'll be fine too. Actually, I even considered this idea that you should staple the sheet you brought to the exam to the exam, because that tells me what you think is interesting and important in the course, because that's the stuff that you think will come. And it's still fine, you know, if you want, staple your one sheet that you bring to the exam, you know, so that I have it and I'll know what it is that you wrote. That's about the exam. And normally exams will be long. They would not be anywhere near as involved as the homework questions, as you probably saw by comparing the homework questions to the sample midterm I gave. And I try not to play Russian roulette in the sense that if you somehow pick 4 topics and only study those, you should only get 4 out of whatever 100, you know, if there are 100 topics. Okay, that's the way I try to write the exams, and so everything important would be asked. Okay, so you don't need to worry, maybe I just, you know, have to pick exactly 3 topics and study them, you know, all of them are important and you should be able to see by now what are important. And as I said, you go to the class page and look at the description around all the audio lectures. That tells you what I remembered after each class. Okay, and if I didn't remember, then probably it's not important. Okay, although I can still ask that. Okay, so at least you'll get an idea about what, that's a review, essentially. It's a quick review of what topics were covered. Okay, any other questions? Nothing, just the sheet, that's it. I mean, book reference in the exam. No, I think I have given you enough. I mean, you can study the entire world. I would not stop you, okay? And there are tons of, you know, places where there's information about this available. You can study all of those too. I mean, but I would not necessarily, I mean, you wouldn't be at a disadvantage if you only studied what was taught in the class. That's all I can say. Neither would be at an advantage because, I mean, by studying more, you would not lose anything. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So, For today, we will be continuing the discussion about clustering. In fact, hopefully, I will complete the discussion on clustering today. And so that when we come back for regular classes next Tuesday, we will be talking about filtering and classification, which are essentially like the recommendation systems and collaborative filtering and all that fun stuff. Okay. So if you remember last class, before I left, we were talking about cluster evaluation. There are two types of evaluations for clusters. One is the internal evaluation, which is the only thing you have if you don't know what the true clusters are. Most of the time you're given the data and you're supposed to look for the clusters in the data. Okay, and the best you can say is, are the clusters that I'm coming up with nice and round and shiny? Okay, so presumably you would be looking at how tight are the clusters, how far away from each other are the clusters. So intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance are the two measures, and a function of those two would then somehow define the quality of a particular clustering. Okay, remember that, so in fact, suppose if I have a bunch of points, right, if I have a bunch of points, then I can come up with a clustering like this. That's one clustering, and then I can come up with another clustering. That's a green clustering. Okay. The question is, which clustering is better? And the way you compare these two clusterings is, for each clustering, you consider the intra-cluster tightness and the inter-cluster distance, and then combine them in some way that you have decided. You can sum them, for example, or you can do alpha times 1 times, you know, 1 minus alpha times the other, and then you then pick which clustering has the highest value for that, the best value for that. Okay. By the way, as long as we are at it, if I have k documents, remember we are interested in clustering over documents, okay, mostly in this case. So if I have k document, I'm sorry, no, if I have n documents, and I want to put them into k clusters, let's say, to make my life simple, how many different ways can I cluster n documents into k clusters, assuming that the clustering is exhaustive? That means everybody should be in some cluster, and the total number of clusters should be k. So here's another way of looking at it. So there are k clusters, okay, each of the guys can come into any one of them, right? So there is k power n, and the order doesn't matter, k factorial, k power n by k factorial. Now this is for k clusters, and you need to consider all clusterings, okay? Maximum, how many clusterings can you have? How many clusters can you have maximum? What? Which was this one? Why?
Yeah, because always possible that why
did you say that it has to be in multiple clusters? Because I am picking each document, I'm deciding to put it in one of these clusters.
Okay.
There are k possibilities. Okay? So it's k power n.
Yeah,
and then the order doesn't matter, so k factorial. Okay? So now this, and if you want to really get the total number of clusterings, since I'm not given the number of clusters k to begin with, by the way, I'm using two words which are close by, but you know, but have very different meanings, and make sure that you get it. Clusters are this is a cluster, okay? Clustering is a particular set of clusters that spans the data, and that you decided is the way to group the data. Okay, so this is the number of clusterings of k clusters. Okay, now I can have k equal to 1, 2. How many possible clusters, maximum clusters, can I have?
N.
Okay, So that's the total number of clusterings that you have over n documents. If the clusters are partitioning, that means they don't, you cannot allow the same thing to fall in multiple clusters. Okay? So it's first of all, you're looking at all these clusters, and one of the things about quality metrics for the clusters is if I give you a quality metric, then I just need to generate all these candidate clusterings, find out which one has the best quality. So that's the brute force algorithm. Unfortunately, as you can see, the brute force algorithm is going to be really bad because it's going to look at exponential number of clusterings and compare each of them. So mostly what we will be doing when we get to actual clustering algorithms is look for greedy approaches, which sort of construct one clustering and hope that it is the best. Okay, rather than actually look globally at all possible clusterings and find the best one among them. Okay, so this is, you know, the way I wrote this here, this is a simple optimization problem. There are these many finite number of different clusterings, each of which have a quality metric based on the inter-cluster, and intra-cluster measures, and then you're picking the best one. Okay, anyway, so that's the internal measure. The external measures were the ones that we were discussing when we left the class last time. In the case of external measures, the idea is that somehow somebody knows the true clustering for this data. Unbeknownst to you, somebody has in their mind a true clustering for the data. And they're comparing the clustering you came up with to the clustering they have in mind. Okay, so in that case, essentially, so for example here, suppose I made three clusters of points, and it turns out that the true clustering for this data was based on the color. That means somebody expected that all the red guys should be one cluster, all the blue guys should be one cluster, all the green guys should be one cluster. So the true clustering was red one cluster, blue one cluster, green one cluster. And the clustering algorithm came up with these clusters. The question is, how bad is this? Right? The way you would consider this, one idea is to think in terms of purity of the clusters. So this is almost a purely red cluster with one blue guy coming in. And this is almost a blue cluster with a red and a green guy coming in. And this is almost a green cluster with two reds coming in. So the purity of this cluster is, as I said, 5 over 6. This one is 4 over 6. This one is 3 over 5. Okay, and then you consider the weighted combination of the purities to get the overall purity of the clustering. Okay, where the weights are the size of each of the clusters. Okay, why is the weighting important? Because if you don't take weighting into account, there is a simple way of getting highly pure clusters, which is what? A degenerate way to get very pure clusters. N clusters, N different points, N different clusters. Okay, so each point is its own cluster, each document is its own cluster, in which case it's a pure cluster. Okay, so then basically the size is taken into account this way. In fact, if you have N possible documents in N different clusters, that assumes that you can allow any number of clusters up to n. But suppose I told you only 5 clusters are allowed. In this particular case, suppose I told you only 3 clusters are allowed. Even then, you can play, if I don't take into account the cluster size, you can play with purity in the following way. You can basically take 2 of the n points, put them into 2 different clusters, and the rest all into the third cluster. Then you have 2 highly pure clusters and 1 non-pure cluster. And if you don't take the size of the clusters into account, then it looks like this is a good idea, which it isn't. Okay, so that's one way of doing external measure of clustering. Now remember that normally you do not know what the external true clustering is. In most applications, you don't know what the true clustering is. This is some sort of a posthumous check. Okay, so you might check how your clustering works on some known cases, and then when you actually apply it in the real world, in fact, many a time, people consider some things to be clusters because the clustering algorithm said so. We will talk about when we get to hierarchical agglomerated clustering, etc. We'll actually, in fact, in general, this is true in many scenarios. In bioinformatics, for example, people try to look for the machine learning people to tell them what are groups, so that the biologists can then see whether those groups make sense. Okay? It's basically the the tail wagging the dog. Okay, so essentially, the guy who is looking for clusters in syntactic measures is telling the semantic people, you know, what the real clusters are, because they have no clue what are the real clusters. Okay, so true clustering, it doesn't exist normally. Okay, so if it does, then you can use this. One other idea for comparing clusters, which is kind of a useful thing to do, is, again, the same idea where, suppose I have so this is basically sort of closer to precision recall based. So here I consider the number of points which are in the, so suppose I have a bunch of clusters in the true clustering. Here is this cluster, here is this cluster, here is this cluster. Okay. Now what I would be looking at is for every point, is that point present in the same cluster in the algorithm's result as well as in the true cluster? Okay? If so, those points which are in the same cluster, both in the algorithm and in the ground truth, that's the number here. A is the number here. Okay? If a bunch of points belong to the same cluster in the ground truth, but some of them got split into a separate cluster, that is the number C here. Okay? And then different classes in ground truth. If you have points which are in different clusters here, but they got put in the same cluster here. Okay? Here we are assuming that the names of the clusters are known. Okay? Names of the clusters are known, and you have introduced a mapping between the clusters you made and the clusters that correspond to the true clusters. Okay? So you know everybody what cluster they're supposed to be part of. So think of 571 and 598 and 494 are the true clusters for this class. I came up with some random two clusters. Okay? The tall people and the short people. Okay? Now I would decided that the tall people corresponds to the 494 cluster, and the short people corresponds to the 598 cluster. Then the question is, if a point is in the same cluster according to both the algorithm as well as the ground truth, then it gets counted this way. If it is in a different cluster, it gets counted here. So if they are in different classes, but they got put in the same cluster, that means two unlike things got put in the same cluster, that's a bad thing for the clustering. And similarly, two different things did get put in two different clusters, that's good. These numbers should be high, and these numbers should be low. You add these up, you essentially get the number of points. Okay? So you can essentially talk about a notion of precision, which is A over A plus B, and recall, which is sort of a notion like a recall, which is A over A plus C. Okay? Precision and recall are with respect to whether the clusters are actually pure and whether they are bringing everybody who is supposed to be in that cluster to that cluster. Okay? So if you can combine this precision and recall to something called the RAND index method, which basically just says A plus D by A plus B plus C plus D. Yes. You could, but this is, again, you know, there are different ways of quality measures. There are ways of combining these. But the interesting thing is, previously we looked at purity-based measures. Here you're looking at whether things are in the cluster they're supposed to be or not.
And again, here you have the issue that you need not necessarily know your ground truth.
Yes. I mean, the external evaluation only works if you have the ground truth. Okay, clustering is unsupervised learning. That means, in fact, it's learning, it's inductive inference. That means you don't know ground truth most of the time. When you actually use clustering, when you actually use learning, You don't know what the answer is. You hope that the hypothesis formation that you learned will tell you what the answer is, what the real label is. So the best you can do is check whether the clustering is working on a few cases for which you happen to know the ground truth, and if it does, then you hope that it will work on the unknown cases too later on. Okay? Okay, so that's the external and internal measures. And as I said, if once I have the external and internal measures, mostly when an algorithm is working, basically all it can do is take the internal measures into account in deciding how good a clustering it can get. And then if two algorithms can come up with two clusterings, if you happen to have the ground truth, you can do some sort of a testing on them on the ground truth. This is sort of ground truth may be available for quote unquote training data. And on the test data, you won't know what the answers are. Okay? As I said, the algorithm for finding clusterings would just be, since there are only a finite number of them, compute these measures for each of the clusterings and see which is the best. Okay? But obviously there are too many clusterings. And so you want to try and do some sort of iterative algorithms. Okay? You could throw this out as an optimization problem and let somebody else deal with the optimization, which is one possibility. The other is look for greedy approaches which sort of get you to a reasonable clustering. Okay, and when you're looking at these greedy approaches, we will be looking at actually two kinds of things. One called the k-means kind of clustering, which basically sort of put points into different clusters. So actually you'll see what k-means is, and the hierarchical clustering, which essentially says clusters are supersets of other clusters. Okay, and we'll look at both of them. So there are, as I said, there are partitioning methods such as k-means, which basically try to partition the data into exactly k clusters. Okay, and the question is, what should be those k clusters? Okay, and k-means, some of you probably know that algorithm, but the rest of you would have fun learning it. It's not that hard to understand. And then there are hierarchical methods where essentially, you know, k-means kind of methods require the number of clusters to be known in advance. Especially k-means requires the number of clusters to be known in advance. Hierarchical clustering essentially just says, well, at the lowest level, everybody is unique. Okay? So there are n clusters at the lowest level. At one level above, some of these guys are closer, some of these guys are closer. So two clusters at the top level. And then the very top level, everything is just one cluster. So you can actually see the hierarchical structure of how groups become subgroups of a bigger group. Okay? So it's sort of an easy hierarchy of clusters. So that's not surprisingly, like for example, humans are mammals, and mammals are animals, and animals are living things. Okay? And not surprisingly, in fact, we'll see that the hierarchical agglomerative clustering, which one of the approaches, agglomerative clustering, will produce something called a dendrogram, which is sort of what a evolutionary diagram looks like for, for evolution, for a particular genus. Okay. Yes.
The criteria for clustering should be always nature than similarity.
What?
The criteria for clustering should be based always on similarity.
Yeah. Distance or similarity. Similarity is the opposite of distance. Now the question is that a major constraint? Not really, because I can decide how to define similarity. Do you understand what I'm saying? All I am saying is I need, the way we think about this is these are points in some n-dimensional space. And you might think, my God, if you think of them as points in n-dimensional space, somehow this is constraining. Well, it's not really constraining. Change your dimension. I can make you points in a two-dimensional space of your height and your class status, whether it's 494 or 598. That's one particular dimensionality. Another thing would be your nationality, your height, your nail size, and so on and so forth. And so there are two different dimensions in which you're still a point. And then having decided the points, I can still decide, decided the space dimensions, I can still decide what the distance is between two points. And that's the question of, remember when once we decided to make documents to be vectors in the space of keywords, we still had the question of how do we define their distances. You could do Euclidean, you could do Jaccard similarity, you could do vector similarity. Okay? So
it's not really limiting. The real question is, what's the right distance measure? What's the right set of features in such that define the space? That's the most important decision that everybody assumes it's already decided, too late to think about it. But really, that's the most important question. You know, by the time points are given to you as, I mean, you know, data is given to you as points in n-dimensional space, where the n dimensions are decided by somebody, that means they have decided what the important features are. And there could be completely wrong features. And doing the best clustering in the wrong space doesn't tell you anything. Okay, but if I did give you the space, I still have to decide what distance measures and I have to give you one slide which is missing here. Okay, so suppose I was doing this for text, okay, and for documents, I'll assume all the documents are points in the space of keywords, which is what we've been thinking of. Okay, so we can still decide which keywords. We'll assume, if nothing else, all the words are equal. Okay, and then we can also talk about what distance metric. You can use Jaccard, you can use Euclidean, you can use vector similarity. One advantage for vector similarity, since we're going to mostly use vector similarity anyway, unless I tell you otherwise, we'll assume that we'll use vector similarity. Now, it has certain interesting properties. This distance measure has certain interesting properties because it's a dot product distance measure. And that winds up having some useful properties with respect to clusterings. Okay, for example, one of the things you might want to do while doing clusterings is how close is a cluster, right? Intra-cluster tightness. Okay, so that basically would be the similarity between a document. You might at some point of time want to consider the similarity between a document and every other document in this cluster, so that this document, already some clusters are formed, this document is coming in and it's trying to see, should I go here, should I go here, right? In fact, in k-means you wind up doing that, we'll see in a minute. Okay, so the way the document probably might decide is, it could decide am I closer to these guys or closer to these guys? So I might consider average distance of this document, average similarity of this document to all the document in this cluster and all the documents in this cluster, and compare those two numbers. Right? Normally that would mean for each document, if this cluster has, you know, C1 documents and this was C2 documents, I need to do C1 similarity measurements here, C2 similarity measurements here, add them up, divided by the number. Right? It turns out that suppose you have these clusters or vectors. Suppose I want to just say, what would be my distance? Another way of deciding which cluster I should go to is to just compare myself to the centroid of the cluster. What would be the centroid of a cluster? If you have a cluster is a bunch of vectors, the centroid of the cluster would be just dimension-wise average. Each dimension, you just add up all the x dimensions, you know, of all the documents, divided by the number of documents. Add up all the y dimensions, divided by the number of documents. Add up all the z dimensions, divided by the number of documents. And that would give you the centroid vector. Now, the centroid vector is not a real document at all. It's just the sort of virtual center of this. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is it can actually be shown, and you know, you can follow this, that the dot product of D1 to the centroid is the same as the average of the dot product of D1 with every other document in that cluster. So these are actually the same. Okay? A more useful thing actually is the following. Suppose you are interested in deciding how tight-knit a cluster is. Remember, intra-cluster tightness is something that we will keep using. Okay? You shouldn't be surprised that we will wind up using it. So to do that, you need to take, in a cluster of size n, you need to take every pair of points, compute their distance, add them up for all the pairs, divide by the number of pairs, that will give you the average distance between any pair of documents. Okay? Right? So the question then is, if you are doing this from a computational point of view, how many distance measurements are you doing? n square, order of n square distance measurement, because there are n choose 2 pairs. For each pair, you need to compute the distance. Right? Now, however, if you actually can see, basically what you're doing is, d belongs to the cluster, d dash belongs to the cluster, the cosine vector, cosine theta of d dash and d is what you're trying to compute. Add them all up. Right? That can be separated into, since this is a linear measure, you can separate this into this part, which is essentially, so the d and d dash are separated into two different sums. Now what's more, and once you change the sums, then d and d dash are basically just any arbitrary document in the cluster. So this is the centroid now, and this is the centroid now. And you're taking the dot product of centroid with itself. That would just be the square of the magnitude of the centroid. Which is kind of cute, because if you didn't know this, you would have wasted a lot of time computing n square distances. But you would get the exact same answer if you just did this linear centroid computation and squared its magnitude. I just basically squared its magnitude. Okay? So that's another useful property, essentially, of the dot product based distance measure. You know, this one, and vector similarity is a dot product based distance measure. Okay, so we'll use this. If I don't tell you otherwise, this is what we'll use. Although every algorithm that I'm telling you later on could use any distance measure, really. If you use these distance measures, you get these extra properties on top to make it more efficient. Okay, so you can actually ask yourself, would this kind of thing have happened for Jaccard similarity, for example? Okay. So I'm going to now talk about the first simple algorithm for clustering that probably several of you have heard of, either in a class or if not, you probably thought about it. That's a reasonable way if a teacher comes to like a grade school and says, kids, separate yourselves into four groups. Okay? Then basically they make themselves into four clusters. Okay, and clearly kids cannot be in two different clusters at the same time, so it's going to be a hard clustering, it won't be a soft clustering. Okay, and so the interesting thing that happens in those cases is some four kids probably sort of randomly go and stand in four different places, and then people start getting into different clusters based on which of these four kids they like. And then as these clusters become bigger and bigger, the new kid who is coming can actually see which cluster does have more of my friends. That's the one I want to be part of. Okay? And then you would, when everybody goes into four groups, then you have the initial clustering. At this point, now, you know, when you went into the cluster, you thought you had a lot of your good friends there. And then some more people joined. Now you feel as if more of your friends are in a different cluster than this one. So now that you see the four clusters around you, you see your cluster is not as good as that other cluster, because that one has more of your friends. Friends, distance. So you can change your cluster now. So quickly people shift. And then you keep doing this shifting until the teacher says, stop moving. Okay? I mean, if the teacher isn't there, the question would be, stop moving when you no longer see any other cluster to be any better for you than the current cluster you are part of. Okay, so the idea would be the k-means clustering essentially starts with the idea of there being k centers. Okay, and then everybody then joins each of these clusters based on which cluster they feel closest to. Now when I talk about that, there is this question of how do I decide which one I'm closest to. One idea would be to compute my distance to everybody in that cluster and divide it by the number of points. But we just said that would be just the same as centroid distance. Okay, so what you would do is you would just take the centroid of each of the clusters you are looking in front of you and see which one you feel, which one you are closest to, and join that. Okay, now here is a little animation of k-means clustering. Okay, suppose I've decided, you know, this is the same one that I showed you earlier, and you couldn't tell whether there are two clusters or three clusters. Suppose I said there are two clusters. Okay? Then the question is, which two clusters? What are the two clusters? Suppose it turned out, I mean, you know, as crazy as it might sound, suppose it turned out that the two guys who decided to start two different parties in the class is this guy and this guy. You know, by looking at the data, you already can see that that's a pretty bad initial sentence, right? Because you would have picked one here and one here. But that's because you already see the global view of the clusters. When you are in the class, you don't know how the clusters are going to be. So you essentially make local decisions. So that this would be as good a divergent case as possible. So we'll see what happens in this case, okay? So here are these are the red guys, these are the blue guys. I mean, this is the red guy, this is the blue guy. He's saying, I'm starting my team and this guy, blue team, and people have to decide which team they want to go to. And remember, as I said, you just compare yourself to the distance to the center of the cluster. And whichever is the closest center, you join that, okay? You being all the rest of the black dots. Okay, so if you do this, then after the first iteration, you would wind up assuming, in fact, it turns out that the classical k-means assumes a sort of a synchronous algorithm. Classical k-means assumes a synchronous algorithm. That means the initial centers will remain the centers until everybody joins one of the clusters. And then you recompute the center. Okay? But in fact, you can already see. So that means as each of these guys are coming in, you know, the center of this cluster is changing really. But you don't recompute it in the classical k-means. Suppose I allow you the option of recomputing the cluster center. What do you think will happen? Would it be a good idea or bad idea? Yes, it will converge faster because essentially there is no real reason for you to only think of the two guys who started the two teams. By the time you are making your decision, you already know what the clusters are looking like. So if most of your friends are in this guy's thing, then you really would like to go there. So if you recompute the cluster center after every change, then you do more work, but you do fewer iterations. Okay, but the classical one assumes the cluster center stays until one iteration. The iteration is complete. One iteration is complete, then everybody joins one of the clusters. At this point, I have a red cluster, I have a blue cluster. Okay, now in this case, I can recompute now the centroid of the blue cluster, the centroid of the red cluster. Okay, these are vectors. Okay, centroid is just x1 plus x2 plus x3 plus xn, xk divided by k, where k is the number of points in that cluster. So if I were to recompute, then it turns out the red state cluster center is approximately here. And the blue state cluster center is here. Now everybody is given an opportunity to change clusters. Okay? So obviously what happens is, in this case, is anybody going to change? These two guys wind up seeing that they're closer to the blue cluster. Right? So these are the couple of Republicans in Boston. And they decide, you know, life is too hard as it is, let's just join the crowds. Okay, so they wind up becoming part of the blue majority here, and this becomes the red majority here. At this point, I recompute the clusters, recompute the cluster centers. So the cluster centers have changed again. This is the real center, this is the real center. Now I again allow people. Remember, every time the people in the cluster change, the centroid of the cluster changes. Right? Okay. So the picture, back in 19th century, if somebody mugged you and then you went to the police station in US and were describing what did that person look like, the composite sketch that they would come up with would be very different from the one that you are likely to come up with now because the country has changed. Okay? So the average person doesn't look the same, you know, where to the extent there is an average person. Okay, doesn't look the same as they did back in 19th century because the cluster has changed in complexion. Okay, so that's what happened here. Okay, so when this last time the cluster centers changed, it turned out that nobody needed to change anymore. So you stop. That's it. Okay, so this is synchronous iteration by iteration, where for each iteration you take the keep the centers constant, and then everybody decides which cluster they want to go into, and then you recompute the centers. And if between two iterations nobody changed from one cluster to the other cluster, that means you have reached a fixed point. You reached a fixed point and you stop. That's k-means. Okay, very easy algorithm to understand. Okay, so the tricky point, of course, is for k-means is picking the original centers. The number of iterations you would wind up needing depends on which centers you picked in the beginning. In the beginning, notice that the centers don't actually have to correspond to any of the data points at all. In the beginning, they happen to correspond to the data points. In my classroom example, two people decide that they're going to, you know, start two groups. So they actually correspond to two real people. But then afterwards, there is no real person who is the centroid of any cluster. It's just an average. You know, if there is in fact a true centroid for a cluster who also corresponds to a real person, that's a totally fortuitous coincidence. Okay? Okay. So, you know, the question is, you know, you have this issue of how to pick the seeds correctly. And then once you pick the seeds, you reassign clusters, you recompute the centroids, you reassign the clusters, compute the centroids, reassign clusters, and at this point when you try to reassign clusters, nothing changed, so you say converged. That's k-means. Okay? Here is one more k-means example, which is on supposedly real data. This is two-dimensional antenna data. Okay, I can't read exactly what the x and y axis are, but something about some data about antenna reception, and they essentially put this is the way the data is. And if you are looking for three clusters, let's see, are you looking for three clusters? No, three clusters actually. Okay, if you're looking for three clusters, and in fact, you know, you started with three random points, this as the cluster centers, and at the time when you found three clusters, you found this is one cluster. Okay, despite the fact that you started with three cluster centers, all of which happened to be very close to one particular locality. Okay, looks like k-means is a reasonably robust algorithm. Okay. What's interesting is actually this picture shows how the centroid changes for each cluster as the iterations progress. Okay. So there were three centroids here, here, and here. As the iterations progress, this centroid kept going here. This centroid sort of stayed here. This centroid kept going here. Okay. Now, one of the interesting things is if I ask you to find k clusters, you will find k clusters. Okay, one might actually say that this data really is two clusters, not three clusters. Okay, looks like this is like one cluster and one cluster here. Why did you find three clusters? You know, I said up to three, you shouldn't have used all three. But unfortunately, k-means is going to just get you the exact number of clusters you asked for. So that's an interesting question, a problem with k-means, which is if you are not given, you know, you have to be given the k, which is the number of clusters to find, and as long as k is less than n, which is the number of data points, you will magically find exactly those many clusters. No more, no less. Because by definition, that's what you decided, and you know, if you're looking for k clusters, you start with k centers, and that will ensure that there'll be exactly k clusters. Okay. So the question is, it looks like this is doing something useful. The question is, what is k-means doing? What is it optimizing? Okay? Remember we said internal measures for clustering are intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance. Okay? Now it turns out, since I have actually fixed the number of clusters, then the tightness of the cluster is enough. If you just take the tightness of the cluster, that will be enough, because the number of clusters are fixed, that sort of doesn't allow too much variance in the distance between the clusters. Okay, so you're always comparing three clusters here to three clusters here to three clusters here. And you would say this clustering is better than this clustering if this clustering has tighter clusters than this cluster. normal comparison might actually compare 2 clusters here to 15 clusters here. And there you really need to take into account both intra-cluster tightness and inter-cluster distance. For k-means, you can ignore the inter-cluster distance because the number of clusters is decided. Now, suppose I am deciding the goodness measure of the cluster, inter-cluster, intra-cluster tightness as the sum of the squared distances from, for each cluster, take the centroid of the cluster, take every point in that cluster, take the distance, that point to the centroid, okay, square it, okay, and then that would give you the squared distance of every point from its centroid. In this cluster, you would again take these points, take their distance from this centroid, sum, you know, square them again, and sum them, and then the third cluster. Okay, then if you do this, then the tightest clusters will happen, since always there will be exactly three clusters. Okay, the tightest clusters will happen, so the sum of the squared distances, when it's reduced, that will also correspond to the best cluster. Okay, now you can actually ask yourself, isn't there like some easy way out? For example, suppose I were to decide on the three clusters by considering two points as clusters all by themselves. Point one, cluster one. Point two, cluster two. Cluster three is everybody else. Okay, now for point one and point two, what is the distance of the point from the centroid of that cluster? Zero. It looks like there is a cheating going on here, as if because these two points wound up making a cluster with just themselves, and so they wound up adding only zero to the total sum. But that's okay, because this guy will wind up adding everybody's distance to the centroid in that cluster. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in a way, the weighting is going on because you are taking every point in the cluster to that cluster centroid. And since the number of clusters is fixed, you would not just arbitrarily wind up having degenerate solutions, having k minus 1 singleton points, and the kth cluster wind up having the rest of the people. Yes? Basically, my point is that if that does not add anything more. That's my point, and you need to understand that. Okay, so the most obvious thing would have been not only consider the sum of square distance from the centroid, but also take the centroid, inter-centroid distances. My point is the optimum would be the same, whether you take that into account or not take that into account, because the number of clusters is constant. Okay, that's why k-means winds up just focusing on that measure. Okay, now what is interesting is that when k-means is going from iteration to iteration to iteration, you can show that this measure monotonically reduces. Why? Because every time you reassign a cluster, it's because somebody thought they were closer to that cluster centroid than this cluster centroid. That means they were adding bigger distance by being in this cluster. By being in that cluster, they will add a smaller distance square to the overall cost. Right? I mean, like, by throwing a Republican in the middle of Democrats, the Democrats are unhappy, the Republican is unhappy. Okay? And so you throw that person to the Republican side. So they will be closer to their centroid, these guys will be closer to this guy's centroid. Okay? So it's clear that as k-means goes from iteration to iteration to iteration, this sum of square distances is reducing monotonically. Okay, now the question, of course, so reassignment monotonically decreases g since each vector is assigned to the closest centroid. Okay, so this is basically what k-means is doing, and when the k-means stops, it thinks it has reached a minimum in the space of this distance measure. If you were to plot this distance measure with respect to all the k clusters, then you know that the reason you don't want to change any further, you know, k-means doesn't want to change any further, is because every local change is going to increase the distance. Is this the optimal clustering?
Depends on when the distance doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
When the GK doesn't change,
that's optimal. GK does not change. I agree that it's not changing. So in a function, I have said, here is a function, okay? This is the space of clusterings. This is G value. Okay? I told you that if you started somewhere here, as K means comes like this, it will come to a point and stop. It would be a minimum. No, I mean, if you think of, G reduces. G is the distance, sum of squares of distances. It keeps reducing.
No, I didn't understand the last part you added.
Where, here?
Yeah.
Here. No, this is, each clustering is a point on the x-axis.
I mean, after the
for each clustering, this point, the y-axis, is the G value for that clustering.
Okay?
And all I'm saying is, if you start from a clustering, K means will essentially get you to the minimum. My question is this optimum?
Yes. No.
Because it is what? Because who told you that this is minimum? It could go like this, and go like this, and go like that. Remember your calculus. Remember your functions. This is just a local minimum. Okay? So, all you know for sure is where you stop would be a local minimum. It may not be a global minimum.
But we already know that G decreases monotonically.
Yeah.
So how can it come down?
G decreases monotonically with respect to, again, this is, think about hill climbing. And those of you who know hill climbing. Hill climbing, I am trying to go up a mountain, Everest. I mean, this is my favorite example, okay? In fact, so I'm going to go up Everest, and I've decided, I don't know what the heck, where Everest is, I have no GPS. So I know that Everest is the tallest point in the world. Okay? So I refuse to move forward unless my next step is going to increase my altitude. If I keep doing this, then when I stop and I stop moving forward, that's because every step I can make is going to reduce my altitude. Is this Everest? That's like Columbus saying, this is India. Because he was looking for India and he found this, let's call this India, and the people here are Indians. Okay, the idea is what you are getting is with respect to your step size, this is every little step you make is going to reduce your altitude. Okay, so if only you looked up, you would have seen Everest sort of looming in front of you. There's no one single step way of increasing your height to get there. You first have to reduce your height before you increase your height. This is exactly what happens in every local search algorithm. The question is, in the case of Everest climbing, I know that only if only I consider larger step sizes, step sizes of arbitrary size, then when I say there is nothing I can do, there is no step I can make of any size whatsoever that will increase my height, suppose if I were to say that, then I would be globally optimal. The reason, but of course if you do that, then you are considering infinite number of step sizes. So essentially you will spend all your lifetime making one iteration takes infinite amount of time. Okay, so the question is, what is the equivalent problem in k-means? What is making k-means local as against global? What can I change to k-means such that it will actually find the global rather than local optimum? When I go from iteration to iteration, what is happening? Yeah, but individuals are changing their allegiances. Individuals are changing their allegiances. They are not colluding. If you want Democratic Party to win in Arizona, okay, it's not enough for one person from Massachusetts to come to Arizona. All of Massachusetts should come and become residents in Arizona. And at that point of time, all the Republicans say, oh my God, this place is teeming with Democrats, let's all go to New Mexico. Then, what?
Or Minnesota,
whichever. Right? And then things change. So the point is, if there is a collusion among multiple people making their steps together, then you will actually get to the optimal clustering. But if you do that, then you are considering, is any one of you liking any of the other clusters? You say no. Then is any pair of you liking any other cluster? You say no. Any triple of you liking any other cluster? So the number of questions you are asking is increasing. So per iteration cost is going to increase significantly. And then you will get optimal. Yes, sir. So the idea is that both at each of them separately, you know, the point is the center, so the idea is the center is going to change together. Now all of us come together. For a while, so the point is if Massachusetts Democrats are coming into Arizona one by one by one, the first seven of them are going to feel miserable, surrounded by all the Republicans, right? But after a million of them come in, they start feeling happy. The real question is, what happens to the first seven guys? You know, they have to go through a local minimum only to come to a better, happy life. If they all decided to take a big plane together and come, changes the world. I'm not saying that should be happening. I'm just saying, if you think, you know, there is a, you know, global optimum in Arizona becoming Democratic, then you may not reach it if you are only considering one person at a time. Okay, this is always going to be the case for all hill climbing algorithms because the step size, the neighborhood has to be reduced to make the algorithm per iteration complexity low. So in the case of Everest, I said the neighborhood is the steps I can make in front of me. But if I increase the step size and I'll consider one step, two steps, three steps, up to 1800 steps, that means I change the neighborhood I'm looking at to decide whether or not there is a better point in the neighborhood. And at some point of time, if you look at the entire search space and see whether or not there's a better point in the search space, then obviously you're going to be optimal. Unless you don't know how to do number work. Okay, you would be fine. Okay, so that's the point about k-means. It is monotonically reducing the g-value and yet it can get stuck in local minima because individual iterations involve individuals shifting from cluster to cluster. That's not a bad thing because otherwise it won't be a good hill climbing algorithm. Okay? Here is actually an example. This is an even simpler example that you can play with. Here are one dimensional points, 1, 2, 5, 6, and 7. Okay? And here I'm doing a k-means clustering on this where I'm just considering two clusters. So suppose I were to pick 5 and 6 as the cluster centers. Let's assume the distance measure I'm using is just the difference between the numbers. Absolute difference between the numbers squared. Okay? So first I start with 5 and 6, then the two clusters would be 1, 2, 5, and 6 and 7. If each individual makes an independent decision as to which cluster to join. Okay? At that point of time, the mean for this would be 6.5, the mean for this would be 8.3. 8 by 3, right? And those are the centroids. Centroids in this one-dimensional space also will be just arithmetic means, okay? Now, everybody gets to change. It turns out that 5 now feels closer to 6.5 because that distance is only 1.5 versus the distance between 8.8 by 3 and 5. So 5 changes, right? And so it became 1, 2, and 5, 6, 7. Then the cluster center for this guy is 1.5, the cluster center for this guy is 6. Now, if you were to consider how the distances, so for these, if you have this as the cluster, let's say, if you have this as the cluster, right, then the centroid of this is 1.5. This point is 0.5 away from it, so 0.5 square. This one is 0.5 away from it, another 0.5 square. This 5, 6, and 7, 6 is the centroid. 5 is 1 away from it, 1 square. 6 is 0 away from it, 0 square. 7 is 1 away from it, 1 square. If you add those up, that's 2.5. You can prove to yourself that this 2.5 is less than what you would have gotten for this cluster. That's all I'm saying. And there is no individuals being shifted around which can reduce this number. Okay? Okay. So let's look at some. So obviously, k-means is a nice little algorithm and it actually has some mathematical basis. It's actually optimizing this intra-cluster tightness and you don't need to consider inter-cluster distance because k is decided upfront. Okay, so it is a true clustering algorithm, and it is only looking at the intra-cluster tightness in a particular way, which is how close is each point to the centroid. Okay, now what would be yes?
Sorry, is there any way when we can, by which we can make K-means global optimal?
As I said, one of which, there are many ways, but one of which is allow non-global, non-local moves, okay, multiple people moving. Another way is, if you are not looking for, if you want guarantee, those are the kinds of things you have to do. If you don't want a guarantee, if you just don't want to get stuck in the worst possible local minimum, then you do random restart. That means, what would you do for k-means? I'll show in a minute that the particular local minimum you will get stuck in depends on the initial clustering you started with. If k-means, in this picture, if k-means were to start with the initial clustering which is here, it will come here. If it is here, it will come here. Okay? So, even though I showed you a couple of cases where the initial centers were quite far away from the true centers that you could see, and still somehow, k-means clustering found its way to a better cluster that you would have thought is better, that's not foolproof. In general, I can start with the wrong centers, and I will just come to the closest, gradient-wise closest. Gradient-wise closest, not distance-wise, gradient-wise closest centroid, the minimum. This is like, in US, for example, what's interesting about Rocky Mountains with respect to gradients? There's a point, how many of you have gone to Rocky Mountain National Park? Okay, good. So one guy, nobody is actually traveling. And I'm sure he is just, in fact, one of the problems is when you come to a new country, you think you should check everything out in a week or two. And if you are hanging around there, you think, how many of you are from Arizona and haven't gone to Grand Canyon? I know a lot of people who are from Arizona and are not gone to Grand Canyon ever because I think they're here anyway. I'm sure Grand Canyon will be, if it's been around for a billion years, it'll be there for another billion. But anyway, so if you were to have gone to Rocky Mountains National Park, one place you go, they will say the watershed point where a drop of water falling on this side goes to the east coast and the drop of water falling on this side goes to west coast. And nothing goes to Mexico, and Mexico is really unhappy about this. Okay, but the point is that that's because of the gradient, because of the way the land goes. It's not going to be the distance. In fact, the entire Colorado is closer to the west coast than it is to the east coast. And yet, if it falls on the other side, it goes all the way to the east coast. The same way here. If you start here, you're going to come here. Okay? In fact, you could even have something like this. Let's say, if you start here, you are not going to come here, you will come here, right? And so one way of ensuring increasing your chances that you will go to the global minimum is try multiple cluster centers, randomly select another cluster center, make one more clustering. Remember, K is fixed, okay? So in fact, for this particular picture, suppose I got two clusters here, right? I'm looking for two clusters. I started with these as the initial centers. I came up with this as the best two clusters, and its number is 2.5. Its sum of square distance is 2.5. Now, to see whether or not this is good enough, I'll pick another two separate cluster centers, run the k-means algorithm again, and see if it is less than 2.5. If it is less than 2.5, take that. That's basically, in fact, that's an idea we will use in something called bisecting k-means, where you just try centers multiple times. And every time you try a different center, you get to converge to a different point. And if that is worse than what you currently have, you say to heck with it. If it is better, you say, that's what I really like. Okay, that's one way. Okay, now, one other question, of course, is much of what we've been talking about is really internal measures of clusters. Okay, now, if I were to put you guys as points in the space, a two-dimensional space of length of nails. I somehow have this thing for length of nails. And, make another crazy thing. GPA. Okay, now you will be points in this space. You can do k-means clustering in this. I can come up with two clusters in this space. The question is this clustering has any connection to real clustering? Well, I don't know what real clustering you are looking for. There are many real clustering of you people based on nationality. That's a reasonable clustering. Based on how grumpy you are, that's a reasonable clustering. Okay, based on your 494 versus 598, that's a different clustering. They're all reasonable clustering. So, in fact, even real clusterings are multiple ones. And the one that I get here may or may not have any connection to any of them. All it's going to look for is the cluster nice and tight? Okay, so if k-means is looking for clusters, when it reaches the local minimum, what do you think would be the shape of the cluster? Remember, in k-means, the clusters are made in such a way, the closeness of the cluster is being computed in a particular way. It is being computed by taking the distance of a point to the centroid of the cluster. Okay? And then squaring it and adding them up. So what shape of clusters would wind up minimizing that? So n-dimensional, it will be spherical, n-dimensional sphere. Okay, so k means is going to find nice little spheres, okay, surrounding the data. Now, if in fact you are looking for elongated clusters, tough luck. Okay, if in fact the reality of your application looks for elongated clusters in a particular space, k means isn't going to find it. It's just going to find circles. Our sphere. Okay, you should know what you're doing. Basically, you know, it's going to get spheres. And but what if the real data doesn't have spherical clusters? We will still find them. You see what I'm saying? I mean, if you give me 18 identical twins, then it should be called twins, I guess. 18 identical people, right? And I give them to k-means and say, make two clusters. Do you think it will say, these are all identical, I shouldn't make them into two clusters? No, it will exactly find you two clusters. Okay? And it's always going to find spheres. And so if what you have is underlying is not spherical clusters, and if you happen to know that upfront, you probably don't want to mess around with k-means. Okay? So the last thing I can do, what is the real time? We are, the divergence between me and what? 11:40. Okay, 5 minutes. Okay. So in the 5 minutes, I can do problems with k-means, and then we'll come back and do hierarchical agglomerative clustering. Okay. So some of the problems. Need to know k in advance. Right? I need to tell you k so that I can find exactly k number of clusters. And even with respect to that k, it won't find the best clustering. That's what we were talking about, how to improve the best k clustering. Now, what can I try, what am I supposed to really look for? If I don't know the k, I just have data. This is something that I do deal with, by the way, you know, when I'm trying to give you grades, and this is a real problem, you should worry about this. When I'm trying to give you grades, must I give all of A plus A, A minus B plus B, B minus C plus C, C minus D plus D, D minus, etc.? Or should I just say, these are all just A type of people. Let's say I'll give them A and be done with it. Okay? I have to decide how many clusters are there in this class. How am I deciding this? Okay? In fact, I've always felt that, so what would be, one of the issues is, let's do the following. Let me look to try and first give three clusters and see how good the cluster distance, you know, squared cluster distance is, and then do the 4 and then 5 and 6 and find the place where the number becomes the smallest, the sum of clusters, sum of squares of the intra-cluster distances becomes the smallest. Is that a good idea? It's a dumb idea. Why is it a dumb idea? Because I always felt that, look at this, A plus A, A minus, B plus, B, B minus, C plus, C, D, E. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. my life would be great if I have 10 students in the class, because I'll give each of them one grade, right? And then they will be the center of their own world. They'll be unhappy, happy, but I have maximized, I mean, I have minimized the G. It can't be lower than zero, right? Everybody is their own centroid. So the sum of squares between each point and its centroid is zero. Zero plus zero plus zero is zero still. So I always like to teach classes which have about 10 people, because, you know, I get to do this. Each person in a different grade, nobody can complain. I can get to say, you are unique. You need a unique grade. You're not at all like anybody else. The bigger point I'm making is, it's a dumb idea to try to increase the number of clusters K and see what the G value is, because G value has to reduce if K increases. And it will become zero when K equal to M. Right? So what you really need to do is, suppose you have the number of clusters here and the G metric here for some particular data, you know, G metric keeps falling as the number of clusters increases. And it will become zero when the number of clusters is equal to the number of points. The more interesting question is, look for the knee, look for the place where the rate of change is slowing down. There's a knee point here, this is a small knee here, it's like a fast rate and slightly slower rate of change. There is a definite knee point here, and there's a clear cut knee point here. So if this were your class grade, I should either put all of you in just 3 clusters, or in 4 clusters, or in 8 clusters. Okay? This is not surprising. In fact, people do this kind of an analysis. If they don't know how many clusters they are supposed to find in the data, they will run k-means, which is a cheap enough algorithm. It's essentially a linear time algorithm, you know, multiple times for different k values. For each k value, you have to run it multiple times too, because depending on the centers, it will wind up getting a lower minimum value. And compare those minimums and see when, you know, the minimum, the rate of fall is slowing down. That is a knee, and you can stop there. Okay? So that's one problem, and the way to solve it basically is to look for the kink. I called it kink in that curve, or the knee point in the curve. Okay. The other, of course, is the local minima. We already talked about it. Here is an example. Here, if I start with B and E as the centers, B and E as the centroids for these 4 points, these 6 points, then I will get ABC as one cluster and DEF as another cluster by k-means. If, on the other hand, if I start with D and F as the centers, I will get ABDE as the cluster and CE as another cluster. If you like this, if you actually are seeing only 2 clusters here and those 2 clusters are this and this, you won't get it if you started with B and E as the centers. That's why you need to try multiple centers and then let the k-means run and see what local minimum it comes to. Okay, that's the idea that you deal with it. Okay, I'll stop here, and when we come back, we'll talk about hierarchical clustering, which does not partition but rather combines data into bigger and bigger clusters.